Hi, I'm Colm O'Sullivan, and this is not our regular Policy Options podcast. In fact, we're starting a brand new series within the podcast that we're calling In Their Words. It's a way for us to share some of the articles that really caught our eye from the digital pages of Policy Options magazine. So every other week, we'll be sharing a new article read aloud by the author or by one of us here at the Institute for Research on Public Policy. For our first episode of In Their Words, we're turning to IRPP Research Associate Paisley Sim, who will be reading her article,
Will Action on Reconciliation Emerge as an Election Issue?
We really hope you'll enjoy hearing these articles and welcome your feedback. So please let us know what you think on all social media under the handle IRPP, or send us an email to communications@irpp.org. We really love hearing from you. Now over to Paisley.
After the discovery of unmarked graves at residential schools, political leaders won't be able to ignore commitments to advance reconciliation. Canadians are heading into a September 20th election on the heels of a summer defined by hard truths and confrontations with our country's violent colonial past. While some are framing the election as a referendum on Canada's response to the pandemic, the decision that voters face is also set against a backdrop of growing calls for action on reconciliation. A 2021 Confederation of Tomorrow survey found that 60% of Indigenous people and 42% of non-Indigenous Canadians think governments have not gone far enough to advance reconciliation. Will this shape the debate? The recent work of the Centre of Excellence on the Canadian Federation at the Institute for Research on Public Policy provides valuable context on COVID-19, the implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and the role of settlers in the challenges ahead. Pandemic must not overshadow electoral commitments that advance reconciliation. Beginning in May 2021, with the discovery of 215 unmarked graves at the site of a former residential school in Kamloops, BC, the graves of more than 1,300 other children have since been found, including more than 751 in Maryville, Saskatchewan. While these discoveries have been uniformly labeled as shocking by settler society, what is even more shocking is that Indigenous communities have known about and advocated for support to uncover these sites for decades, yet Canadian governments consistently chose to ignore them. They were specifically highlighted in the 2015 Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada report. The scope and scale of these willfully delayed discoveries, when finally made public, fueled waves of protest and grief. Public outrage was met by a mix of platitudes, fragmented financial commitments, and political missteps that went on to color this period of national grief. Since May, the federal government has distributed $27 million to First Nations to locate, identify, and commemorate former residential school grave sites, but it is estimated that the total cost to excavate all former sites could be closer to $1 billion. Confronting cultural genocide wrought by residential schools has not been without political cost. Manitoba Premier Brian Pallister publicly downplayed Canada's colonial history, stating, "The people who came here to this country before it was a country and since didn't come here to destroy anything." These comments led to the resignation of his Indigenous and Northern Relations Minister and was later a contributing factor to his own midterm resignation. The existence of unmarked graves places a duty on the state to act because graves contain evidence that is essential to the realization of truth, justice, and accountability for the victims and communities. Anything short of full recognition of this history and action to remedy past harms will likely come at a steep political price. At the same time, most of Canada entered the fourth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. But Canada is vast, and the shape of the fourth wave, like previous waves, will differ greatly across the country. This is especially true for people living on reserve and in the sparsely populated and geographically remote northern communities. For example, while much of Canada was at the tail end of the third wave, Yukon declared a first wave only beginning June 27, 2021. Based on what we know about COVID, younger people who are vaccinated at a higher rate than other groups should be less likely to be infected. Yet, the rate of COVID infections per 100,000 people is 2.4 times greater for First Nations living on reserve than in the general Canadian population. Although infections on reserve are trending downward, the outsized effect of COVID is evidence of insufficient access to healthcare because of systemic racism that is felt through inadequate access to clean water, inadequate housing, and under-resourced communities. This has been especially true in Manitoba, where First Nations make up about 18% of the population, but accounted for more than 70% of cases in the third wave. As the 2020 death in a Quebec hospital of Joyce Echequan, an Atikamekw woman, highlighted for many, the healthcare industry is culturally unsafe and shaped by systemic racism and sexism. While the majority of Indigenous people in Canada live in locations that are not governed by Indigenous governments, according to the 2016 census, 44% of all Indigenous people live in urban areas. Research makes it clear that a cultural match between service providers, what they provide, and those receiving services is critical to effective service provision. Without a concerted effort to match service provision to Indigenous communities, urban and on reserve, it is likely that these communities will continue to have outsized COVID infections compared with non-Indigenous Canadians, despite being younger on average. In its first principle of reconciliation, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission confirmed that UNDRIP is the framework for reconciliation at all levels and across all sectors of society. In their 2019 platforms, the Liberals, NDP, and Green Party all committed to implement this global human rights standard, but the Conservatives did not. On June 21st, Bill C-15, United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, received royal assent. Legislation is a preliminary step towards Canada meeting its obligations under the UN Declaration, so the challenging work of implementing it now begins. The government of BC introduced a law to implement the declaration, and it may serve as a template for the federal government. A starting point is Michael Hudson's 2020 IRPP Insight, which details how the federal government could look at how the objectives of BC's Environmental Assessment Act were changed to implement UNDRIP and give Indigenous communities a greater decision-making role. The way political leaders speak about the shape of UNDRIP implementation and an Indigenous rights agenda will shed light on their fundamental values and their willingness to achieve meaningful reconciliation. In a recent analysis, Cheryl Lightfoot writes that the Indigenous rights agenda is both conservative and radical. It is conservative because its core demand is for the recognition of rights recognized, at least in name, by nearly all countries in the world. It is radical because recognizing that these rights have been denied and that a debt of remedy is owed challenges the legitimacy of liberal democracies like Canada that are otherwise known for abiding by global human rights and the rule of law. The extent to which leaders are willing to recognize and act on the debt of remedy caused by the dispossession of Indigenous lands must be central to the election debate. With 70% of Canadians acknowledging that they have a role to play in advancing reconciliation, up from 55% in 2020, advancing an Indigenous rights agenda is timely and more likely than ever to be on voters' minds at the ballot box. While voting behavior is complex and motivations vary, recent events are likely to affect non-Indigenous voters' perceptions of reconciliation. The experience of COVID on reserves demonstrates continued systemic racism in healthcare and infrastructure. Political leaders should outline meaningful, actionable paths to reach reconciliation goals. This is a moral and legal imperative, and it's something that parties downplay at their peril. Should this issue not rise to become a top electoral issue, a new government will not be able to avoid it when in office. The electoral campaign will ultimately end, but the urgency of reconciliation will remain with us. I'm Paisley Sim, and this has been In Their Words.
Thank you for listening to the first edition of In Their Words, and thank you, Paisley, for lending your voice to this episode. If you liked this, let us know on social media or by sending us an email at communications@irpp.org. And if you'd like to read this piece, check it out on our website at policyoptions.irpp.org. You'll find this in a bunch of other great articles. Thanks again for listening.